Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
If this is Wednesday, there must be another White House debt limit meeting, right? Yeah, there is. We'll talk to one of the Gang of Six about how Washington gets to a deal from where it's stuck right now. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Allianz, providing investment, insurance, and retirement solutions through its affiliated companies in the U.S. since 1896. AllianzUSA.com. And by Reputation.com, monitoring, protecting, and improving reputations online while deleting personal data from the Internet. Reputation.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's Wednesday, today the 20th of July. Glad you could be with us. There is a lot going on in debt limit land today. Not all of it, as sometimes happens in Washington, directly connected to the issue at hand. President Obama's meeting with congressional leaders today to figure out a way to get the debt limit raised. That has, as you know, been the main storyline for a good long while now. But there is something else brewing as well, a huge, and by huge, I mean maybe $4 trillion deficit reduction plan. It's being offered up by three Democratic and three Republican senators, the Gang of Six, they're called. The two sets of negotiations are running side by side, and they might possibly come to the same endpoint, or they might not. Senator Mark Warner is one of the six in the aforementioned gang. Senator, welcome to the program.
Kai, thanks for having me on.
Let me ask you about the timing of this thing. The president said yesterday we are at the 11th hour. It's a couple of weeks till the deadline, so I have to ask, where the heck have you guys been?
Kai, let me assure you, valid question. We should have been out 3 or 4 months ago. But I'd rather at least be out at this point. And, you know, the first issue we have to deal with is raising this debt ceiling. But even raising the debt ceiling doesn't get us to that $14.5 trillion debt that we're all looking at. And I think this approach that we've put forward is a starting point.
We'll get to that approach in a minute. Let me ask you, though, about the debt ceiling negotiations. Are you A, surprised, or B, embarrassed that we're still talking about this at this point?
I'm embarrassed. I mean, it is remarkable to me with the financial disruptions going on in the world, with the crisis with the euro, that we would be playing, in effect, Russian roulette with the full faith and credit of the United States and even take the happenstance that we might have a debt downgrade, which would result in an immediate indirect tax increase on every American family and business through higher interest rates. It blows my mind.
Yeah. Well, let me pursue that just a little bit. I heard you yesterday afternoon on another public radio afternoon program, and you kept referring to yourself as the business guy. I'm just the business guy. I'm trying to make these numbers work, right? So let me ask you this. As a business guy, would you invest in us right now?
Listen, I would never go short on the United States of America because we still got the most open capital markets. We still got the most entrepreneurial people. And, you know, to paraphrase Winston Churchill, you can always count on the Americans to do the right thing after they've tried everything else. Well, we've pretty much tried everything else, so it's time for us to do the right thing now.
So on to the plan from the group of six, the Gang of Six, pick your name. You've been talking to Senator Reid, you and Senator Conrad, your fellow member of the Gang of Six, talking to the majority leader about getting some elements of your plan into a debt reduction, debt limit deal. Can that still happen at this hour?
I'm hopeful. I mean, let me be clear. I want to do nothing that slows down or interferes with raising the debt limit. But to simply have another commission and not take the work that we've done and say, hold it, this ought to at least be the starting point, or this ought to be a fallback position, or somehow build this in, doesn't make much sense to me.
Well, that's a really good point. And it brings to mind Rahm Emanuel's now infamous quote, former chief of staff to the president, about never letting a crisis go to waste. This is the plan you have presented is ambitious. It's got a lot of moving parts. Can the key elements of tax reform and entitlement reform survive absent a comprehensive deal that is forced by the debt limit deadline?
That's the $64,000 question. At the end of the day, there is a grand bargain here. Major entitlement reform for recognizing that we also have to reform our tax code in a way that raises more revenue. What we have now is a framework that provides, I think, that kind of comprehensive approach. It's not perfect.
I have to ask you about the politics of it. There is another chamber in the Congress. You've got House Republicans saying no net tax increases. You've got House Democrats saying we're not going to cut or substantially lessen entitlements. What are you going to do?
Well, I think the numbers at some point are so overwhelming that you've got to find a way to find some common ground. And, you know, that's what we're kind of hired to do. Anybody that can read a balance sheet realizes you're not going to be able to solve this problem on simply one side of the ledger. When spending's at an all-time high and revenues are at a 70-year low, you got to look at both sides of the balance sheet. And the proposal we have, which is roughly, depending on how you count interest savings, 2 to 3 to 1 of cuts over revenues, I think that's a mix that at the end of the day should pass muster.
Mark Warner, Democrat of Virginia, member of the Gang of Six. Senator, thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Washington may be stuck, but the wheels of global commerce do indeed grind on. American Airlines announced today it's ordering up 460 brand new fuel-efficient jets. About 260 of them are going to be made by Airbus, the European consortium. The rest will be built here by Boeing. The headlines you may have seen are calling it the biggest aircraft order ever. And in fact, it is, because American Airlines figured it had to go big or go home. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Except for just two profitable quarters, American has suffered through losses for three straight years. And one of the big reasons has been ever-rising fuel costs. Tom Horton is president of the airline's parent company, AMR. In a conference call with analysts today, he blamed American's aging fleet.
We're looking at total fuel efficiency improvements of about 45% versus our current MD-80 fleet.
Those MD-80 planes were built nearly three decades ago by McDonnell Douglas, which has long since been swallowed up by Boeing.
With this plan, we're jumping to the front of the line to have the latest, most fuel-efficient technology.
In other words, it's not about adding seats. David Swieringa is an industry consultant at AeroEcon.
This order is for replacement aircraft and not a lot of additional growth.
And as for American's contention, it's now jumping ahead of its peers. Airline consultant George Hamlin questions that.
Other carriers also have new equipment on order. American's rival Southwest has recently changed to add the 737-800, which is the same airplane American will be getting to its fleet. So I'm not sure what that statement means.
Hamlin suggests the big order is more of a case of what took so long. The likely answer, American stayed out of bankruptcy, and that's been a struggle.
They've kept their pension obligations intact, for example. They pay on these. That's something to be applauded, but then it produces difficulties on the cost side.
American is aggressively aiming to resolve that now to keep avoiding the flight plan taken by so many of its rivals. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
We had some fun yesterday with the Zillow IPO. The real estate website went public today to the tune of a 79% jump in its share price. Another trendy firm went public today, but investors do seem a little more leery, and I can't for the life of me imagine why. Doesn't a company named Skull Candy sound like a safe investment to you? Marketplace's Jeff Horowitz reports.
Never heard of Skull Candy? That's okay. I wasn't cool enough either. Basically, it sells headphones. Get it? Skull Candy? Headphones designed to make other people's heads turn. Endorsed by rappers, snowboarders, and motocross star Nick Way, whom I've also never heard of.
My favorite Skull Candy headphones, kind of going with my whole persona, I'm a little bit more of the GQ type.
In case you missed it, these days we care a great deal about what headphones our celebrities wear, and we have Skull Candy to thank for it.
They led the way into that niche, not so much from a technology point of view, but from a point of view of being trendy and fashionable.
Jeff Harbaugh is the former president of Nitro Snowboards, now a financial advisor for the so-called action sports industry.
They've been able to grow the market, and they're kind of betting on staying trendy, even as they sell in the big box stores like Best Buy.
Today's IPO values the company at more than $500 million. Freddie Nager talks about Skull Candy with his marketing students at UCLA. Nager says Skull Candy has done a masterful job dressing up decent Chinese headphones. Unfortunately, other people can do that too.
So now any celebrity who considers himself or herself a brand can just call up a Chinese factory and say, hey, I want my name on a product. You know, it really does pose a huge burden on Skull Candy to always be edgier than thou.
Nager says he's got a new assignment for his class. Design a pair of headphones that's cooler than Skull Candy. For mega brands like Nike and Sony, you can bet that assignment's well underway. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
So those white ones I used that came with my iPod, those are lame, is that what you're saying? I guess. I don't know. Wall Street today, Yeah, there was some trading. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. While it's tempting to believe that the markets have been rallying on all this talk of some kind of deal on the debt, fact is, traders are a bit more base than that. Strong corporate profits from the likes of Apple, IBM, and Coca-Cola are really what's going on. That's one economic bright spot. But commentator David Frum says there's another one.
Here's some good news amid the economic gloom. U.S. exports continue to surge. April set a record, $175 billion. May fell a little short, but the United States is well launched to increase exports in 2011 by 25% over 2009, and to double exports by 2014. An economy as big as the United States cannot export its way out of a recession, but the export surge does contain promising signals of the U.S. economy of tomorrow. The U.S. is increasing its exports to China faster than to any other country, despite China's manipulated currency. Computer technology and foods head the list of sales. U.S. grain exports have surged to their second best year since 1982, as the droughts in Russia and Ukraine impelled those governments to halt international sales. Some U.S. industries faced weaker competition as Japan absorbed the shock of the tsunami and nuclear disaster. Above all, exports are driven by the drop in the cost of the U.S. dollar relative to other currencies. If, to make up an example, Martian dollar used to buy $1 of U.S. products and now can buy $1.50 worth of U.S. products, odds are that the Martians will increase their U.S. purchases. A cheaper dollar cuts the pay of U.S. workers relative to the rest of the world, without depressing their ability to buy non-traded goods like housing or to service their debts. A cheaper dollar is not pain-free. Imported goods cost more, starting with the oil that moves American cars and trucks. And everybody who holds U.S. dollars loses a little wealth. Those who hold the most lose the most, one reason that Wall Street squawks when the dollar declines. Through the pain, though, the cheaper dollar shows the way forward to servicing U.S. debt more easily and spurring global competitiveness. Growth resumes. Recovery accelerates. It's a start.
David Frum was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Today, he's the editor of Frum Forum. Next week in this space, Robert Reich, your views, whatever works for you, really. Go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says contact. The news of the British press world has been relatively quiet today. Prime Minister David Cameron named a commission to help investigate the phone hacking scandal this morning. Yesterday, of course, Rupert Murdoch and his son James faced a parliamentary committee, apologies, denials about what was expected. Also, though, a question about whether Murdoch Sr. might have been guilty of willful blindness. Murdoch said, absolutely not, but it did get us thinking about that phrase, willful blindness. So we dialed up Margaret Heffernan over in the UK. She's written a book, as it happens, on this very topic. Welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot.
The common sense definition of this thing we can kind of figure out, but there is also a definition of willful blindness at law as well, isn't there?
The law defines willful blindness like this. If there's information that you could have had and should have had but somehow managed not to have, the law deems that you're willfully blind and treats you as though you had known. In other words, ignorance is no excuse. You're still responsible.
You actually quote the judge in the Enron case, just to go back a good decade or so. I mean, he actually laid it out.
Judge Simeon Lake laid out this idea when he was instructing the jury in the trial of Jeff Skilling and Ken Lay. And I was reading that pretty much at the same time as the banks were all collapsing. And it just, you know, lit a light bulb in my head.
You know what it's a little bit like? It's a little bit like when you're 5-year-old, you tell him you want him to do something and he sticks his fingers in his ears and goes, la, 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 right?
That's absolutely right. I mean, it's also, you know, there's a very kind of common thing where you don't really say what you want. You just say what the results are. So in management speak, it's, you know, don't bring me problems, bring me solutions. And implicitly what that's saying is sort of, you know, I don't really care how it gets done as long as it does get done. Well, you know, the opportunity for some ethical problems there is just immense.
And there are, of course, all kinds of psychological reasons this happens. I mean, it's just easier sometimes to pretend something's not happening. But lay it out for me in the corporate structure. How does it come to be that a guy running, in Rupert Murdoch's case, a 53,000-person organization can conceivably say, I just don't want to know?
Well, first of all, the very size of the organization may be part of the problem. You know, it's virtually impossible to have any kind of clear line of sight across all the operations of an organization like that. In addition, you have to take into account what we know about human psychology. People are obedient. They will follow instructions even when they're unethical. This is what the New York psychologist Stanley Milgram proved in the 60s, and the data has been robust ever since. You can add to that other experiments we know about conformity. Given the choice between giving a wrong answer that keeps you part of the group or a right answer that makes you an outsider, most people would rather give a wrong answer. There is enormous psychological pressure on individuals to do what the organization wants and what their boss wants.
Well, since this concept then is so tied up in that sweet spot of corporate behavior and human nature,
right,
what's the answer?
Definitely, I think we all need, as managers and executives, to learn to be very good at negotiating conflict. The people who see most clearly are those who seek disconfirmation. They want people who are prepared to argue with them. They want data that challenges their beliefs. You know, that's how they keep alert, paying attention. Because if you're surrounded by a lot of yes men and women, the chances are they will all keep you blind to the stuff that collectively you just do not want to see.
Margaret Heffernan. She's the author of a book called Willful Blindness, Why We Ignore the Obvious at Our Peril. We've got an excerpt of it on our book blog. It's marketplace.org/thebigbook. Margaret, thanks a lot for your time.
It was my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Coming up, when are private companies not private companies?
They actually have private shareholders who expect a profit. They have executives who are compensated on profits.
When they're government-owned. The saga of Fannie and Freddie. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, after yesterday's exuberance, investors turned cautious on this Wednesday. The Dow Industrials gave back 15 points, a tenth percent, 12,571 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ off 12 points, four-tenths percent, 2814. The S&P 500 basically flat, ended things at 1325. Profits and big contracts provided a few bright spots. Stellar earnings late Tuesday kept Apple on the ascent today. Shares gained 2.75%. As we told you, American Airlines announced the biggest commercial plane order in the history of planes. Boeing, which bagged 200 of those jets, saw its shares climb 2.2%. American Airlines parent company AMR struggled, though. A quarterly loss knocked its shares down 0.2% today. Skull Candy? Yeah, not so much. Headphone maker we talked about earlier in the show closed flat right at its IPO price. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Barron's Magazine, providing market ideas and insights to help readers manage their investments and protect their financial well-being. Online at Barron's.com. And by Better World Club, offering green roadside assistance nationwide. Committed to changing the world, not just tires, at BetterWorldClub.com. For more about the latest business and economic news from Marketplace, visit Marketplace.org to discover even more of the news you love from Marketplace. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Conference Board releases its monthly index of leading economic indicators. A House Subcommittee on Health holds a hearing to address bioterrorism, controlled substances, and public health issues. And actor and comedian Robin Williams turned 60. Nanu Nanu, I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
We took a moment the other day to talk about Moody's and Standard & Poor's, the ratings people, and how they've been threatening to downgrade American debt should Washington fail to agree on a credible deficit reduction plan. Andrew Northrup of Ossipee, New Hampshire, says credibility is the key word there, not about the debt plan, about the raters themselves.
Moody's and S&P showed themselves to be at best incompetent and at worst criminally negligent just a few years ago when they reassured us all that these financial instruments we now call toxic assets were just fine. I guess it's hard to put much stock in their opinion today.
I mentioned a new social network called Proust.com yesterday. It's for seniors to share their memories digitally, assuming, I said, you can actually get your grandmother online. Some of our more... and I am going to get in trouble here. Some of our more distinguished listeners didn't appreciate my whippersnapperosity, as one put it. That includes Nancy Glick, a 63-year-old grandmother from Bend, Oregon.
Shame on you, Mr. Rizdahl. When I bought my first computer 28 years ago, your comment denigrating seniors as being computer-averse might have been true, but I can assure you that my 60- and 70-year-old friends are all online. And in February, my 72-year-old husband and I designed a website for a volunteer organization.
Shame indeed. Finally, designer nail polish. Last week, Kate Betts explained to me how colors are back on ladies' fingernails this year. Jake Raderick of St. Paul, Minnesota, objects.
I did not mention the use of nail polish by men, which is becoming a trend. And there are companies now that even produce more masculine or earthy colors for men.
Some of those colors, by the way, bullfighter, coal miner, and blue steel. Yeah, I don't know. You can send us your thoughts or your color suggestions. Just go to marketplace.org, click on the link that says contact. One can say this about the American housing market. At least it's not getting our hopes up. Used homes sales, rather, fell to a 14-year low last month. The two government-owned companies that are behind almost all the residential mortgages in this country, they're facing some challenges of their own. There's an ongoing debate in Washington about how to reform Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. In suburban Detroit, meanwhile, there's a multi-million-dollar lawsuit over unpaid taxes and over exactly where Fannie and Freddie sit on the spectrum of public company or private concern. From Michigan Radio, Sarah Hewlett reports.
Like most states, Michigan has something called a real estate transfer tax. It's paid when a property changes hands.
We're standing out in front of a really beautiful home in Troy, Michigan, that sold in 2008 for about $353,000.
That's Andy Meisner. He's the treasurer of Oakland County, north of Detroit. The brick home behind him has a three-car garage and a soaring entryway. The problem with this home, and many others like it, Meisner says, is that it was sold in foreclosure by Freddie Mac, which, like its sister Fannie Mae, claims to be exempt from paying Michigan's transfer tax.
The total lost revenue on that transaction was $3,040.10.
Meisner says the mortgage giants owe the state and his county more than $12 million in real estate transfer taxes over the past 6 years. He filed a lawsuit last month challenging Fannie and Freddie's tax-exempt status as government entities. Fannie Mae was created by the government during the Great Depression to support home mortgage lending. It was converted to a publicly traded company owned by investors in the late 60s. Freddie Mac launched in 1970 and went public in 1989. Fannie and Freddie have been under government conservatorship since the financial crisis. Both declined to comment on the lawsuit. Meisner says the companies are trying to have it both ways, enjoying the profits of a private company and the protections of a government entity.
If it walks, flies, and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And Fannie and Freddie walk, fly, and quack like private companies.
Whether Meisner prevails will depend on the judge's interpretation of state and federal law. Anne Graham is a professor at Hamline University in Minnesota and an expert on banking law. She says there is a case for deeming Fannie and Freddie private.
They actually have
private shareholders who expect a profit. They have executives who are compensated on profits, just like any other publicly traded corporation.
One argument against, though, is Fannie and Freddie's own charters, which exempt them from state and local taxes. Whatever the outcome of the suit, it's already caught the attention of other local officials around the country.
What we've seen is in local government, we have really been stuck with the final bill on this foreclosure crisis.
That's Phil Ting. He's the assessor recorder for the city and county of San Francisco. He estimates San Francisco is losing about $1.5 million a year in transfer taxes that would otherwise go to pay for things like police and roads.
What Oakland County has discovered is similar to what California's looking at, which is how one industry has really got very, very preferential treatment in this process. And it's a question of, does it really make policy sense?
Ting says he'd like to see a ballot initiative in California that would require the transfer tax to be paid when a homeowner defaults and the property reverts to a financial institution. He says he's keeping a sharp eye on what happens in the Michigan lawsuit to see whether Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac might be subject to that tax as well. In Detroit, I'm Sarah Hewlett for Marketplace.
You want to know how the mortgage market works? We've got a video primer on Fannie and Freddie and the rest of the Mae Mac clan on our website. Patty Hirsch is back from sabbatical with another whiteboard explainer. This one's called Meet the Maze. It's at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by FreshBooks, an online invoicing service designed to help business owners save time, manage their books, and make invoicing easy. More at FreshBooks.com. By Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, just because we haven't touched on oil in a while. Crude closed up today just over $98 a barrel. Told you that so I could tell you this. OPEC is out with an interesting report. It's updated the rankings of countries with the world's biggest proven reserves of crude. Saudi Arabia, not number one anymore. Politically challenging as that country is, the new number one is even more so. Venezuela, our fourth largest supplier in this country, now has more crude than anybody else, waiting to be drilled and sold. And that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Wednesday. Today, the Dow gave back 15 points, about a 10%. The NASDAQ off 12, 4/10%. The S&P 500, we'll call it flat. Vahan Baladuni, Robbie Carmen, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time, back here, send in those resumes, gang. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is hiring.
We haven't met a bad apple, if you will. We haven't seen a bad hire in terms of the intellectual capacity to do the job.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.